I don't know how many of you have really thought much about the importance and the value of Bible geography, but today we're going to talk a little bit about that and also, in particular, emphasize that the Bible lands were a testing ground of faith for the children of Israel, and that how we can thereby learn some great and valuable lessons from those tests that the children of Israel were placed through because of where they lived. Before we get to that, I want us to consider that Bible geography is indeed important for a variety of reasons. And we don't have time to go into all of these in any kind of detail, but I want you to see that it does remind us that the Bible story was a part of a real place and part of verifiable history. Number two, it helps us to visualize the events and places of the Bible story. Number three, it helps us in gaining a greater understanding and a more in-depth appreciation of the Bible stories and facts. Number four, it heightens the emotional and sensory impact of the Bible stories and lessons. And number five, it has an apologetic value. That is, from defense purposes. I don't think I've turned this on.
No matter. Is that better? There we go. Now, when you consider, for example, number four, and consider where David was when he wrote some of the Psalms and referred to God as a mighty fortress and as a rock, and then know by reading through the pages of God's Word that he was at times finding his escape or refuge between the hill country of Judah and the Dead Sea in this area known as the wilderness of Judea, where today a place is located known as Masada, this huge outcropping of rock where Herod actually had a fortress built upon there, and the Romans actually took control of it at one time, and then the Zealots took control of it from them. But it was only accessible through what was called the snake path, a small, narrow trail leading all the way to the top of this large outcropping of rock. And so a small band of soldiers could defend themselves against a large army below because they would have to come up one by one or maybe two at a time. And so to think of that, when David spoke of God being his rock, his fortress, his high tower, we thus can have a little more of a, it has a little more of a sensory impact upon us when we consider it from that perspective. So a lot of these things have examples I don't have time to go into today. But I just want to encourage all of us to learn as much as we can about the geography of the Bible lands. And when we talk about geography, we're not talking about just finding a city on a map or locating a mountain range or identifying a river. But we're also talking about elements that have to do with hydrology, the study of water sources and water collection. It also has to do with the study of climate and, as we'll see today, how the climate affected that land. It also has to do with the drawing of boundaries when it comes to geopolitical positions and territorial boundaries set by nations. And so there are a lot of things that go into the study of geography. Today, as we talk about the Bible lands, I want us to quickly narrow our focus and to start in a large way, then narrow down, remembering that the Bible story takes place on three of the seven continents. When we look, for example, at this little small parcel of land right here at the eastern edge of the Mediterranean, we can see that the Bible story took place on the continent of Asia, on the northeastern part of Africa and Egypt, and then, of course, into Europe, going up into places like Philippi and ultimately Rome. Now, as we narrow our focus even more, we'll know that those three continents, as you can see, converge right here in this area around the Mediterranean. The word Mediterranean literally means middle of the earth. It's a Latin term, and the Romans so identified that sea as the middle of the earth, probably from somewhat of an egocentric perspective, thinking of themselves as being the center of the world. But indeed, it is on that sort of central area that connected them from the east to the west and so forth. So the Mediterranean Sea forms an important part of the Bible story, especially during the first century as Paul and other disciples, Christians, took the gospel from Jerusalem to various parts of the world. So we're looking at right here, of course, this northeastern part of the continent of Africa that includes the story of Moses and Jesus as a young boy coming down to Egypt this area, and also because of the dynasties and the rule that Egypt had over areas like this that we'll talk about in just a moment. Now, as we broaden out to the east a little bit, you can see more clearly this land that we're talking about here. This land right here is this area that is known as the Promised Land. The primary extent of that land was only 150 miles if you measure it from Dan to Beersheba. Now, that's as the crow flies. So a small parcel of land, a small parcel of land that is a part of what is known as this Fertile Crescent. And you can see how it sort of makes a crescent shape. Some take that crescent, that Fertile Crescent, on in here into the Nile Delta region. But there is an area good for farming in between these rivers or along the rivers of the Tigris and the Euphrates River, known as the Mesopotamia. And the word Mesopotamia is actually made up of two Greek words, meaning the land between the rivers. And so it is here that the Bible story really begins, with Abraham dwelling in Ur of the Chaldees and coming over to a land that God would show him, a land that ultimately would belong to his descendants. Now, what's so important about this little piece of land, and why is it that I'm calling it today a testing ground of faith? Well, one of the things that we need to know about this small parcel of land, Dan located somewhere up in this region, and then Beersheba located somewhere down in here in what's called the biblical Negev, or the southland of Israel. And in between here, only 150 miles, but you can see a mountain range that goes from north to south. And then you can see the Dead Sea area and the Jordan River Valley that's well below sea level, especially here. And then the Transjordan Plateau, and then the Eastern Desert over here. And then this coastal area that connects Egypt and then on over to what would we refer to as the Mesopotamia area. There was, as I've mentioned already this week, an international coastal trade route, or a major branch of it, that went right along this area here through some of the Philistine territory, came up here to this mountain range, the Mount Carmel range, and had to go through one of three different passes, one at Megiddo, the other one at Jokneam, and another one at Jenin, that put you into the Jezreel Valley, that allowed then traders to come up into here, into the area of Phoenicia, or cut through these valleys here, over to Galilee and Capernaum, and then on out over to the area of Mesopotamia, where the great empires of Babylon and Assyria and the Medo-Persian Empire existed. Now, this particular area that we're talking about is quite diverse. A lot of people have in their mind, when they think of the Bible lands, an area that maybe looks something like that, very rugged, with maybe a sea or something around it. This is actually the Red Sea here, near, of course, Egypt. But as you go from there throughout the desert of Sinai, that the Bible calls the great and terrible wilderness, to differentiate it now from the wilderness of Judea that is uniform in its climate and that is thought of a place of refuge in some ways between the Dead Sea and the Judean hill country. This is the great and terrible wilderness in the Sinai Peninsula that is very diverse in terms of its composition and very few places to find water. It's often thought of as a place of death. But you come up from that Sinai Peninsula area, going through some areas where trade and some caravans of camels would carry spices and other types of things from the east, going down to Egypt or bringing papyrus up to the land of Palestine and other places. Coming into areas like this, the wilderness of Zin, where Hagar was banished to this wilderness, if you'll remember from the book of Genesis. Up all the way to the Dead Sea, as you see in the background, where here in the Judean wilderness, again, pretty rugged, barren, very little vegetation, but some animals can live out there. And at certain times in the spring, there may be on the edges of the Judean wilderness grass that's growing where herdsmen would bring their flocks, but primarily a fairly barren area in the southland. If you go to the Dead Sea, and if you're in your mind looking at the Dead Sea and go south of the Dead Sea, you have what's called the Arava, which is a complete wasteland in the sense of not really used for much of anything, especially in Bible times. In fact, only about 2 inches of rain would fall there and still does today annually. So in the south, very dry, very arid region. But as we begin to make our way up, we see here a picture of Masada that I was talking about a moment ago, and the three-tiered palace that Herod had built here, one, two, and a third one here, that he had hanging off the edge here, as well as a lot of buildings and a synagogue and even a swimming pool that were built up there, believe it or not. But the Dead Sea, very, very barren. But then you make your way a little further north, up into the Jordan River Valley, and it becomes a little more tropical. At least there's a more vegetation in this area. And on up into the Jezreel Valley, where there's a lot of growth, a lot of farming and planting. Sometimes this is called the Valley of Megiddo. There's also, escapes me now, but the name of a valley that goes from the Valley of Megiddo to the Jordan Valley. But a number of Bible stories actually take place right here. This is where Saul was killed, approximately somewhere in this valley. We know also that Gideon fought a number of battles here, or fought a great battle here. Deborah and Barak, the story of Deborah and Barak take place here, or Deborah. And so a number of things. You go here to the hill country of Judah, and you can't quite make it out in this picture, but there's a lot of terraced farming here. Olive trees maybe, but mainly grapes are grown in this particular area. And then you go to the north area, and you see some real lush areas with a lot of grass in an area known as Golan, or sometimes called Golan Bashan. And that's in the northeastern part of this area that we're calling the Promised Land. And it's in that area that the Bible sometimes refers to the cows or the kine of Bashan. And you can see in the distance what? What is that? Mount Hermon. And notice it has snow on it. And there are parts of Mount Hermon that have snow on it year-round. Even today, there is a small, it's only about 200, 300 yards long, but a actual ski slope up there. It's the only place in Israel that you can go and snow ski, but they actually have lifts that carry people up to this real small slope, but mainly used, I think, in training and for the military and some other things. But nevertheless, you can see that the country itself is quite diverse in terms of its vegetation, and as we'll see here, in terms of its fruits and so forth. Now, here is a great Bible verse that we're familiar with, and one that we want to consider. I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of the land into a good land, and a large, and to a land flowing with milk and honey, under the place of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now, we remember this story of the report that came from the spies that went to spy out the land after the children of Israel came into the wilderness. Here in Exodus 3 verse 8 is a reference to this land being called a land flowing with milk and honey. That is probably a term that is sort of a colloquialism, a figure of speech to refer to a land of plenty, a land that has a lot of different vegetation to it, a land that has the opportunity to grow, as opposed to literally flowing with milk and with honey, although honey could be found there. And you'll remember the story of Samson and the beehive that had made its home inside of the carcass of a lion. And so there are a good number of things there in that land, as you'll see here in just a moment, that make it indeed a land flowing, a land that has some springs in it, a land that has in areas, some tropical areas, a land that has, of course, the Mediterranean Sea, as you see here near Tel Aviv, or actually this is at Caesarea, and go all the way to the north at Dan, and at the base of Mount Hermon, there are a number of springs that form the headwaters of the Jordan River, and here is one of those springs. So quite lush indeed. There's a story of the tribe of Dan that is of interest to us. You might look on some maps when you examine how the tribes took over the land of Palestine and the territorial boundaries, allotments were given to them, how that on some maps that Dan, the tribe of Dan, is located right near the Philistine coastline, between the Judean hill country and the Philistine coastline. Well, they got tired of being a buffer between the Philistines and the Judean hill country, and so they left and actually relocated in the north. And you can probably understand why they stopped, as they traveled and went up there and found them a parcel of land that they then decided to settle in, the Danites. Well, you go from there to Mount Gilboa near the Jezreel Valley, a beautiful area, flowers there growing. In fact, when I was there, I thought a lot of Texas. They're sort of on the same longitude or latitude, and they're also, as far as some of the terrain, looks a little bit like Texas, doesn't it? You know, with the rocky hillsides and maybe some scrub oaks and trees growing here and there, at least out in the Texas hill country where I live. You don't consider this the hill country, do you? What do you consider this area?
Central Texas.
Okay, well we're right on the edge of the hill country there in Dripping Springs, and that land, at least parts of it, especially from about Samaria downward, remind me a lot of the area that we live in Dripping Springs. You go down to the west, down near the Philistine coastal area, in those east-west valleys that I spoke about the other night that bridged the territories of the hill country with the coastline, you have what's known as the Shephelah, and these sort of U-shaped valleys that broaden out, as opposed to the V-shaped valleys that are very, very, very narrow in the hill country area. You have places where wheat is grown. So, again, just to give you some idea of the diversity of the land, and when it comes to fruits, you have date or palm trees that have dates. You have various types of herbs and spices and plants that are used for a number of things, like hyssop that you'll be familiar with. And all of that, again, is a part of this small little area right here, okay, just between about the Dead Sea, the Sea of Galilee, around Hazor and Dan, coming down to Beersheba. Now, we do know that David extended the borders of Israel all the way down here to Elot, and even included areas of Damascus at one time, but that was the extent of it. Primarily, it was from Dan to Beersheba is this area that we're talking about right here. Although God had granted them all of this, they never took control of the entirety of it. Now, other things like olive trees can be found. There's a picture of an olive tree. Large citrus fruit. So a land flowing with milk and honey. You can see when they saw maybe the size of some of this of the citrus there, types of plants and fruits, that they didn't think this is an opportunity maybe for us to make something out of this land, especially considering the fact that they've been wandering in the wilderness and they see the barrenness of it and the dryness of it, and now they come here and they see an opportunity to grow. Even though there are some areas that are very dry, there are still some areas that receive a fairly good amount of rain. Now, here's some quotes as we think about the Bible story and geography in particular that I want you to consider as we talk about the Bible land that will then move us down to the main point of our lesson today, and that is this. The Bible is not merely history, it is purposeful history, for it teaches us how to live. Its message is embedded in the everyday lives of people, most of whom lived in a small area called the Bible land. Knowing this land, makes the biblical message more potent. That message remained the same for the days of the patriarchs to those of the apostles who walked the paths of their Israelite forefathers and knew their biblical roots. Now listen to this. Security and peace are not characteristics of the land of the Bible. The north was under the shadow of imperial invasion, and highways in the west were common military objectives. Keep that in mind. Marauders from the south and east posed a threat to settled populations and to the commerce. When empires retreated, local nations fought bitterly in order to control the land's highways. Periods of peace and security were few, short, and far between. Geographical forces make the land a composite of opposing features. Many of its roots are constricted by uplifted limestone hills, deeply eroded canyons, and sharp geological faults. The Rift Valley rips through the land from north to south. Its seas, swamps, or dry, inhospitable plains impede travel. A shift in the world climate can bring drought and famine, rendering the land and its inhabitants helpless. Without a central government to intervene, the farmer is overrun and his fields decimated by invading herdsmen. Now, whoa, what happened there? I think I punched something wrong. What did I do? Okay, I'm sorry about that. That little red button there is hard for me to, the infrared. There we go. There we go. All right. Good. Okay. Now, I think this is the last slide that we're going to read, and then we're going to get into some very, very interesting things here. Abraham was called to this land after the Exodus from Egypt. Moses and Joshua led the Israelites back to this land. David and others built kingdoms here. The capital city of Jerusalem eventually fell to Babylon, but Jews returned from exile and restored a Jewish religious and political entity. In all of these periods, this small and insecure region served as God's testing ground of faith, where saint and sinner struggled against internal upheaval and external threats. Personal or national existence could never be taken for granted, and the people of Israel were called upon to live by faith. We sometimes forget about the fact that this important point right here in many ways tested the children of Israel. Because the Bible land, if you get nothing from this lesson today, think about this. The Bible land is indeed thought of as a land bridge or a highway. Now think about that. A land bridge or a highway. In fact, Isaiah 19:22 through 25 speaks of it in a metaphorical sense. That as Isaiah prophesied about the future, not only in terms of Israel, but the coming of the Messiah, that it would be a sort of highway by which God would make known a lot of things. He would use that land as a means to get to other places, as a means to test His people. And so it actually refers to it as a highway, getting from one place to another. Now, we'll look at these passages in just a moment, but I want you to remember them and keep them in mind. Deuteronomy 7, Judges 2, and Isaiah 31. Because they speak about the trust that the Israelites needed to have in God as they considered the place that they lived. The land is a testing ground of faith, number one, because it was a land in between, and number two, because of the climate that we will speak about in just a moment. Remember, we looked at a map like this just a moment ago. This is a land bridge. Why? Here is the great dominant empires of Egypt, the great dynasties of Egypt. Here is where the empires of Assyria, Babylon, the Medo-Persians that took control of this area, all of them, in their quest for world dominance, wanted to come down through here. Not so much because of its natural resources, because the land of the Bible lands didn't have a whole lot of natural resources other than some of their basic crops and things like that were of value and importance to them, but because of the trade that came through there. And also, as you think about any nation that expands, and here is Babylon, for example, it wants to reach out, and as it grows as an empire, as it has to feed its people, and then also, very important, right, as these empires are growing, some of them have a thirst and a lust for opulence, for the desires of materialism, things of this world. So they want to sustain themselves and their lust. So they've got to go out to other places to get that. Silk. Papyrus, gold, wood, like the cedars of Lebanon. Think about any country, like even the United States. We have interest in other places, right? To sustain our economy. And so it was in the ancient world. Not only did they want to reach out to these areas so that they could gain access to the trade going up and down the Mediterranean and through the Bible lands, but also to protect their borders. We'd rather take the fight, right, if you're in Babylon, to people over here, not in our homeland. And so they extend those borders out. And so here's Egypt. They're creeping up into here. Babylon says, no, we want this. And so the further away we can keep them, the better. Plus we have access to that trade. Who's wedged in between? The Israelites. The small country. Not only is it wedged between these great world empires, but you need to see that it is, in fact, a land bridge. What's to the west? The Mediterranean Sea. What's to the east? What's all out here? Desert. You're not going to take an army through the desert. Not only is it going to be harsh on them as they travel through it, but they're exposing themselves, right, to another army. They could see them coming from a way off and set a trap for them. So you don't want to come through here with a large army. Now, there would be small caravans of herdsmen that will come up through here with their camels, carrying their wares, that knew the places to stop and how to live in the desert. It's hard to move an army by ship. And in those days, you just sort of went from place. You didn't travel, really, through the midst of the Mediterranean. That was very rare. You hugged the coastline as you went places. But still, here's your army coming here. You're not going to find a bunch of ships to get them on to come down here. You want to come down this land bridge. So, an important piece of property that gets wedged between two dominant world empires, or not just two, but two areas that had world empires in it, and the children of Israel in between. Now, to complicate things, and here is an example of what I'm talking about there, and you can see it a little better. Great empires of Egypt. See, they've got to sustain themselves in terms of their buildings and their desire for certain things. Rome did the same thing. In fact, they depleted, before I go to the next picture, Rome depleted a number of natural resources in Palestine because of their thirst and their hunger for blood and the gladiatorial fights and all of that. What besides people did they put in the arena in the gladiatorial fights? Animals. See, you go to the Bible lands today and you don't find a lion, you won't find any bears. But the Bible says that they're there, right? Remember, David said, I killed a lion and a bear. God, they were there. Why aren't they there today? In most part because of what happened with the Romans who were capturing animals and bringing them over to be slaughtered and killed in their arena. And then also the Turkish Ottoman Empire in the 16th century, they pretty well decimated the forest in much of the Bible land. There were probably a lot more trees in those days than there are today in Palestine, although a lot of that vegetation is coming back through their conservation efforts. But nevertheless, these empires and their thirst for material things and to sustain their people causes them to reach out into these other areas as they grow their empire and in their desire to have control over the world. Well, you've got something else at work here. Not only do you have these larger empires, but you have these smaller ones, these smaller countries like Ammon, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Philistines, right? And then the Bible mentions in Isaiah as well as in Judges. Chapter 7, or Joshua chapter 7, I believe it is, and then also in Deuteronomy chapter 7, there's a passage there that mentions the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites were the ones that actually had control of Jerusalem before the time of David. So you've got these smaller nations, and they're trying to survive. They're affected by the world empires, and they're all vying for control over areas where there is agriculture. They want trade. So let me just ask you a question. If you were Israel and you saw the great Assyrian Empire coming down your way, what might you be tempted to do with these other nations to protect yourself? Huh? Make friends with them, right? Form a coalition. And that's exactly what God said not to do. Don't trust in them. You don't form leagues or coalitions with these other nations. See, this is a testing ground of faith, because here are these world empires coming down into our area. We see these smaller groups too that we're kind of battling with from time to time. And of course, they're very different from us. God said, you remain as a separate and a distinct people. All right? But nevertheless, and here's a picture that has the seven nations of Canaan here that are mentioned, and in and around. So they're dwelling in and among these people. Now, they should have driven them out, as God told them, but they failed to do it, and they suffer the consequences as a result of it. You see another better picture here of some of those nations that they had to deal with. Now, before we go there, I want you to turn over in your Bible to Deuteronomy, and let's take a look at a couple of passages here. And I want you to see that not only was there a temptation to trust in these other nations, but also with Egypt. Now quickly, Deuteronomy chapter 7. I don't have my glasses. They're in my bag right there. Maybe I hold my hand out far enough I can see it. Look at verse 1. Deuteronomy 7 verse 1. Now here we are. They're about to take the promised land, right? And God gives them further instructions on how to live in that land. After He's already given them the law of Moses. And then here's more of it, and more instruction about living in the land. When the Lord your God shall bring you into the land, whether you go to possess it, and have cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, and when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt, now notice, make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Neither shall you make marriages with them. Your daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto your son. So, that's one among some of the passages in the Bible that speak about their remaining a pure, distinct race, about relying upon God, not trusting in other nations, nor forming coalitions with them. Now, go forward several hundred years to the book of Judges and take a look at chapter 2. We sometimes refer to this as the dark ages of Hebrew history. And in Judges chapter 2, we see part of their problem. Also, when you think of the judges, what strong, mighty man do you think of? Samson. What did he do? What did he do that we just read that he shouldn't have done? Yes. See? So you see what's happening. They're assimilating into the culture. The temptation to want to go down and be like the Philistines, or to, you know, to ingratiate them in some way so that they'll take care of us. And then, but times we're fighting, and other times we're making coalitions with them. And Judges chapter 2, verse 1 says, "And the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and said, I made you to go up out of Egypt, and have brought you into the land which I swear unto your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no league with the nations of this land, or the inhabitants of this land. You shall throw down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this?" So as a result, what happens in the period of the judges? The children of Israel get overrun by some of the local areas, because at this time, some of the more dominant areas like Egypt and the empires of Mesopotamia had not yet grown to their full power. Or at times, there was a time of regression. But here locally, there is this interchange and this struggle for power and strength. And what's happened is now because they haven't trusted in God, these nations that were mightier than have overrun them. You read a little further on about the story of Gideon. And God comes to Gideon and says, "Gideon, the Lord is with you." And he said, "Well, Lord, if you're with us, why has all this befallen us? They're dwelling in caves. They're living, local nations around them have come in, and they've got so many sheep and cattle. The Bible says that hundreds, you can't even count them all. Why has this befallen us? Well, because of their sin. God would deliver them for a while, or deliver them, and then they'd fall back into it. And so they're getting overrun. And they're seeing these problems. And so what do they cry out for? What do they want when they see all these other nations around them? They think their problem is they don't have a what? A king. A centralized form of government. Everybody else has got a king. We're just all sort of divided up and we're not organized. So we need a king. And God said, no, you don't. And they said, yes, we do. And so eventually God granted them the king, essentially saying, you're going to be sorry. And sure enough, they were. You see, because it wasn't in men that they should trust and in human government in and of itself, but rather they needed to trust in God. And they weren't doing it. So time goes by. And it looks like maybe God doesn't know what he's talking about, because for 120 years they've got a united kingdom. But then we know what happens. Jeroboam is the catalyst to dividing the kingdom. The northern 10 tribes established themselves and they called themselves Israel. Not one good king lived during that time. It was a time of oppression, a time of oftentimes a famine, a time of difficulty, a time of licentiousness, a time in which they practiced idolatry. And now, flip forward to about the year, or the 8th century B.C. and go to the book of Isaiah. I want you to see something. Isaiah chapter 2. What's happened? Isaiah chapter 2. Here we are, 8th century. And out to the east, the great Assyrian Empire is on the move. There is a smaller country to the north known as Syria. Again, not to be confused with Assyria, the empire. There is a smaller nation to the north of the Bible lands called Syria. Now look at what happens. Chapter 2. The word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. It shall come to pass. Well, that's not the passage I'm looking at. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the... Chapter 7 is what I want. Isaiah 7. Chapter 7. Look at verse 1. It came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. Now let's get the players here in this story. You've got the king of the north, and the king of the south, and the king of Syria. Who is the king of Judah? Who's the king of Judah? Huh? Well, look at Ahaz. See, came to pass in the days of Ahaz, who was the son of Jotham. He was one of the kings. Ahaz is the king of the southern 2 tribes. Who is the king of the north, or the northern 10 tribes known as Israel? Pekah, P-E-K-I-A, or Pekah, however you say it. And then who is the king of Syria? Alright, Rezin, right? Or Rezin. So, 3 major players here. Syria, the northern 10 tribes known as Israel, and Judah. Look at verse 2. It was told the house of David, okay, now that's Ahaz, saying Syria is confederate with Ephraim. Now Ephraim is a name that refers to Israel, the northern 10 tribes. They're confederate. In other words, Syria and Israel have formed a league, a coalition. Now they're going to try to force Judah to join their coalition. Now here you are, you're Ahaz, and you're the king of the southern 2 tribes. And not only is Assyria looming in the background, but now your northern countrymen have formed a coalition with Syria, and they're trying to force you to join that coalition. You're put between a rock and a hard place. You've got to protect your people. You're a king. You've got to make a decision here. What are we going to do? You know, I look at all these people. Now, God, I know you told us to trust in you, but pragmatically, I probably ought to do what maybe is good in terms of protecting our border. So I scratch my head a little bit and I think, who could I get to help us? Just to the south of us is who? Egypt. Let's get Egypt to help us. So when you read through Isaiah, you read about this interchange between, as well as the Chronicles, you read through this about this interchange of what's going on, or the kings, between these coalitions of smaller nations and larger nations. And now I want you to flip ahead to some of the denouncements that finally come upon Egypt. Take a look at chapter 30. Let's see. Let's go to chapter 30. Let's look at that one. Then we'll go to 31. So God, through Isaiah, pronounces judgment on the people of Judah and the other nations. Listen to what he says, verse 1. Woe to the rebellious children, saith the Lord, that take counsel, but not of me, and that cover with a covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin, that walk to go down into Egypt, and have not asked at my mouth to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh, and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Look at verse 7. Oh, this is awesome. Why are you doing this? The Egyptians shall help in vain, and to no purpose therefore have I cried concerning this. Their strength is to sit still. Verse 9, that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Lord, which say to the seers, you know, the wise men, see not, and the prophets prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things. See, we don't want to hear what you said about what God told us to do in Deuteronomy. We see what's happening before our eyes here, and we need to do something about it. Now look at chapter 31, verse 1. Chapter 31, verse 1. Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help, and stay on horses, and trust in chariots, because they are many, and in horsemen, because they are very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord. In verse 3, he says, now the Egyptians are men and not God, and their horses flesh and not spirit. When the Lord shall stretch out his hand, both he that helpeth shall fall, and he that is helped shall fall down, and they shall both fall together. So the next time we read Isaiah, and we say, well, what was God so upset about? Why these 30 long chapters of pronouncement and judgment and these judgment oracles? What's going on here? Folks, it's been a long time in the making. God's been patient. But little by little, they kept assimilating into the culture. God kept giving them a chance. He was patient with them. He rescued them when they repented. And yet, here, finally, it's almost the straw that breaks the camel's back. They'd rather not even talk to God. They'd rather go seek the advice of someone else and get their help and trust in the strength of Egypt instead of the mighty God of Israel. Well, I think we can begin to see why the land itself is a testing ground of faith. Because it must have been daunting to think of these world empires, and here you are wedged in the middle. Now, a lot of illustrations could be made in that regard today. How we think, well, God, I know you said this, but you know, maybe we ought to work it out this way. I know you said step out in faith, God, and to grow the church in this way, but you know, I see what all these other groups are doing, the denominations, and God, it might be better if we did it this way. I mean, on and on we could go. God, I know you said that I'm to love my wife and to treat her in that way, but God, you don't understand the pressures that I'm going through and what's happening and the temptations I'm facing at work. Oh yeah? When did you ask God about help and strength? You've got to trust in Him. We're right now living in a testing ground of faith of our own in this world filled with spiritual or with wickedness. We've got to trust in God. Now, I'm an American through and through, and I love this country of ours. But I'm not going to put patriotism over serving God. This country could fall. We've got to trust God. We've got to always do what's right. Now, the last thing, and quickly, is this. And we can talk more about this. But this is a testing ground of faith because of the climate and because of agriculture. As we end our lesson, I want you to look at Deuteronomy chapter 11. This is very interesting. Deuteronomy chapter 11. Again, another bit of advice before they go into the land of Israel. Look at what he says. Now, verse 8. Deuteronomy 11, let's start in verse 8. Therefore, shall you keep all the commandments which I have commanded you this day, that you may be strong, and go in and possess the land whither you go to possess it, that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore unto your fathers to give unto them and to their seed, a land that floweth with milk and honey. Now listen carefully. For the land where you go to possess is not as the land of Egypt, from whence you came out, where you did sow your seed and watered it with your foot as a garden of herbs. But the land whither you go to possess is a land of hills and valleys and drinks water of the rain of heaven, a land which the Lord thy God careth for. The eyes of the Lord your God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year even unto the end of the year. And it shall come to pass, if you shall hearken diligently in my commandments, which I command you this day, to love the Lord your God, to serve him with all your heart, with all your soul, I will give you the rain of your land in its due season, the first rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in the corn. Now, the King James word is corn here, but they didn't have the same kind of corn that we do today. It's wheat. The King James translator thought that that's what they were talking about, but it's wheat. And your wine, this grape juice from your vineyards, and your oil, you see, the oil that came from the olive vineyards, I will send grass in your fields for your cattle, that you may eat and be full. Okay, but make sure what? Take heed to yourselves that your heart be not deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, and on we go. Now, let's look at that real quickly. Here is the land of Egypt. What's it like? Along the Nile River and the Delta region, very fertile. Look at the contrast. You can see this very vivid line between the desert and the Nile Delta region. The Nile comes up and it spreads out. And in Bible times, it flooded every year. You could almost set your clock by it, they said. And with the flooding of that area, what happens when flood comes? Yeah. You push out that old, you know, salt and everything begins to build up in your ground, and also you have to let the land lay fallow if you don't have floods, if you don't have another water source or replenishing the soil. But the Nile didn't have to worry about that because every year it's replenished. So they could keep growing and keep growing, and then they had ways to channel their waters. Look at this. They could flood their fields. No wonder papyrus grew well there. No wonder they had such great vegetation. What did he say? He said, the land you're going, when you came out of Egypt, the land you're going to is not like the land of Egypt, where they watered it with their foot as a garden of herbs. Look how lush this area is. The Nile River. Look at that. Didn't worry too much about whether it rained or not. Got this water source coming through here, keeping the ground moist and replenished with new nutrients so that they could harvest. But the land you're going, look at the valleys. It drinks the water. It rains and the water goes and runs off. So you've got to learn to collect it, and you've got to learn to depend upon God for it. In the south, in Beersheba, where they grew wheat, an average of 10 to 12 inches of rain per year. And then you want the rain, he says, the early rain and the latter rain. In other words, you need the rain to come at the right time, because when you're growing wheat, if all of it comes at one time and rains for days and days and days and days, right before you get the wheat in, what's going to happen? Yeah, you can't. You got to get it in. It's going to mold, isn't it? Or what if it comes too early? And you got to plant. And you guys in here farm? You can't farm when the ground's muddy, can you? You know, it's got to fall right. And if the rain comes right when the ear, the kernels is about to produce, and the rain comes then, oh, you get a bumper crop. So you trust in me. In fact, the Bible land, as according to the climatologist and the agriculturalist, they will describe it as a semi-arid climate. To the north, a very tropical area. To the south, very arid. So semi-arid. It's in this transitional zone. Sometimes you may not get any rain. Sometimes it goes up and all the rain's up there, not much here. It's a land dependent upon God. A land that drinks the waters. It's got trenches. It's got some springs. It comes down and filters down through God's natural filtration system, and all the sediment hits an impermeable layer and then moves laterally out in the form of a spring, or you can dig wells down to it in some of the lower places. A land that will grow well. If you trust in me, I'll send you the rain that you need. I'll give it to you. And you can have grass in your fields for the cows to eat. They're those cows of Bashan. That's not a picture in Texas, by the way. That's actually in Israel. All right? Look at that wheat. An area that they grew wheat here in Beersheba. Pretty barren area, but if the rain falls just right, you can grow wheat there and you can get it done. Finally, this. The northern 10 tribes said, well, you know Baal, this Canaanite god, their chief pantheon, he's a god of fertility. He is the god of the storm. In fact, he is depicted here in this ancient stela and monument with a scepter in the form of a lightning bolt. Here's another one here. Lightning bolt. That's what many archaeologists and others have interpreted as his scepter, because he's the god of rain. So here I am in the northern territories, in particular in Samaria, and I'm thinking, maybe it might not be a bad idea, even though we don't know if we believe in that god or not, but you know, he is the god of fertility. Let's make some sacrifices to him, just in case. We want our land to be fertile. And so they start worshiping and serving Baal. What happened when that occurred? And Elijah comes and pronounces what upon the land? A drought. It's a long drought. They didn't get their water because they trusted in Baal. And then, of course, we remember the duel that he has on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal. And what's significant about the sacrifice and his to call upon your God to consume the sacrifice. Wow, well, he's a God of lightning. Surely he'll send a lightning bolt down and consume that sacrifice. But to prove that Jehovah is God, Elijah has all this water poured on the altar. And God consumes the sacrifice. And then he tells his servant to go, and he looks, here he is on Mount Carmel, and you go to the Mount Carmel range, you can look out over the Mediterranean, he's looking for clouds. And the clouds come. Folks, reading through the Bible story and the interchange of the environment, that is the climate, the rain, the nations, all of that are important elements to better appreciating the stories of the Bible and to see that they were in a land that was a testing ground of faith. I hope maybe this has been helpful and encouraging to you, because we are in our own, as I mentioned a moment ago, testing grounds of faith today. We've got to learn to depend upon God, not upon human wisdom or on our own ideas. Or when we're going through hard times, we've got to look at the bigger picture and see eternity. Not focus on the one specific point in time in our life right now, but look at the big picture. And trust in God and His promises, because He will keep His covenant. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.